If your passion lies in elite British road racing and you want an inside line on the teams, riders, organisers and sponsors that make this sport such a compelling spectacle, you're in the right place. I'm Timothy John, and joining me for every episode is my co-host, the Managing Director of Brother UK, Phil Jones.
Thanks, Tim. It's great to be here. We're going to use this platform to talk about all the key issues surrounding the sport. With special guests, deep dives into hot topics and plenty of chat, we'll keep you informed about all things UK racing. Stay tuned.
Coming up in this special edition of the Brother UK Cycling Podcast, to celebrate a record-setting ride from Brother UK-sponsored Rebecca Richardson, we learn why aero is everything when you're planning to ride more than 100 miles at an average speed faster than 20 miles an hour.
I was asking everybody who are real aero geek, what do I do? Anybody wanting to do an attempt, they just need to look at the aerodynamics. You know, how can they best improve their chances of that average speed? That's what it's all about.
We discover how a little encouragement goes a long way with riders engaged in grueling endurance challenges.
In 2018, when I did my Tour of Britain One Day Ahead, I can recall, here's me, a grown man in my 50s, seeing another grown man in his 50s at the side of the road, and me bursting into tears.
And we gain fresh insight into cycling fundamentals like nutrition by considering food through the eyes of an athlete seeking fuel for the ride.
It's interesting to think of nutrition in those terms, purely in terms of fuel. We think about anything that we digest in terms of taste and flavour and enjoyment, or the opposite. You know, actually, to think about, we don't want too much fat in this because that will slow the absorption of carbohydrate. That's a very distinct perspective.
Hello and welcome to this 10th edition of the Brother UK Cycling Podcast. Today I'm joined by my co-host Phil Jones, the Managing Director of Brother UK, and by a familiar face with a new cycling record to her name. Rebecca Richardson, since we last spoke, has established a new women's record for the Brecon Beacon Circuit, certified by the Road Records Association. And if that sounds like a mouthful, well, the difficulty doesn't lie in describing the challenge, but in riding it. Specifically, in Rebecca's case, in riding 104.5 miles at an average speed of 20.7 miles an hour. Rebecca, thanks very much indeed for joining us today. I mean, where to begin with such a grueling endeavour? You're known as a hill climber, of course, so what inspired you to take on a solo endurance challenge?
Hi Tim. Yeah, I'm mostly known as a hill climber, but actually my background's probably more long distance. Growing up in Wales, you know, you just end up riding the lanes, riding big miles. Also did a bit of touring back in the day, when it back sort of 2015. So during the lockdown, we've not really had any races. Hill climb season's obviously tail end of the year, and I just felt I needed a bit of a challenge to get me through some difficult times in January when we had the lockdown. It enabled me just to find the mental courage to actually get on the turbo. And by doing that, it sort of had a positive cycle and feedback loop. And that was really what was behind the challenge.
So you're turbo training away there like a demon, trying to get yourself through lockdown. Remember you telling me sort of earlier that, you know, you'd kind of got to 4 hours, which was a leap in itself. And then we're thinking of something even greater on a turbo trainer, when the Roads Record Association was suggested to you.
Yeah, definitely. I think a lot of people can probably understand when I say that, you know, getting outside is my therapy. And when they announced in December that there was going to be a lockdown, it was a bit of a shock to me because I was going to have to stay indoors to look after my son, do my work, and somehow try and do my exercise. So initially getting on the turbo was just really awful for me. Like, I was mentally dragging myself to that machine and telling myself just to do 1 hour. Once I'd accomplished a week of this, I realised that something really weird was happening, and I was actually starting to find some mental solace on the turbo. I realised that I was able to switch off, sort of numb the anxiety of the stressful situation. And I found that I was starting to willingly, like, do more hours on the turbo. Eventually, I did 4 hours of my own accord and enjoyed it. And through this process, I realised that so many other people were going through mental challenges in the December, January lockdowns. It made me think about how much I'd accomplished in getting on the turbo and then how much it helped me, you know, find new energy. And I just thought, oh, it'd be great to do a challenge that promoted mental health. Initially, I thought about doing a 12-hour turbo. So I sent Jonathan Schubert a message, and Jonathan Schubert rode the fastest 100 last year. You might have heard of it. And he did it through the Rose Record Association. But he's also a national 24-hour champion. So I thought, who better to ask about a 12-hour than Jonathan Schubert? Mentioned it to him, and he said, well, great idea, but how about a circuit record for the Rose Record Association? And I thought that it was a brilliant idea. A long distance event that was in Wales on my home grounds in my local county and would give me that extra impetus to keep training on the turbo, and behind the scenes maybe I could do some engagement with my sponsors and the local kids club, you know, to try and have a positive impact.
Rebecca, can I ask you a quick question then? So when you're doing these 4-hour sessions on the turbo, I mean, for anyone that does turbo sessions, you know, normally they're the thing you like the least. What were you doing for those 4 hours? So are you using a training platform? Are you just sort of cranking out, you know, watching Netflix, or are you cranking out a part of a performance plan that's prescribed for you?
Doing both. I'm on Zwift, which is a platform. I signed up to do a 200-kilometre endurance ride. So that was getting me onto the turbo at a specific time, because they always happen, you know, they have a start time. But then also it was in line with my training plan. So it combined two factors, you know, my training plan and a platform. On those longer rides, you get quite a committed amount of the Zwift community on them, and they have a great messaging platform. So whilst you're riding, people are communicating, and I found that really helped.
There was a really interesting article in the New York Times recently, Rebecca, about written by an organisational psychologist, and he termed the phrase languishing, which is about those people who are sort of in this whole lockdown period have just sort of sat in the middle somewhere. They're not sort of mentally unwell, if you see what I mean, but actually what they are is just sort of not really feeling a bit foggy. And it sounds to me like by creating this goal for you, what it's done is sort of cleared that fog and given you that real objective to sort of get stuck back into, giving you some purpose for your training, and also to sort of get up and out of bed every day to crack on again and do those turbo sessions, which we can all identify with the fact that it's not easy to sometimes drag yourself to the garage or the outhouse, wherever you have your turbo, and crank a session out. You know, you need that motivation or guess of that wider goal to aim for.
Definitely. It actually sharpened my mind for sure. I had a lot of high pressure work on at the time. My brain was not ready for it. And also, I would say that in the last 12 months, actually, it was really interesting. I had a chat with my coach about 2 months prior to this sort of January time. And I said, I'm not sure what's wrong with me, but I kind of feel like I'm detraining. And he was like, well, that can't be right, because your data says, you know, you're fine. And I'm like, no, I think I'm detraining in my brain. And he said, it was interesting, I'm not the only person who's sort of, you know, experiencing and sort of wording, vocalizing this kind of thing. And the only way I can describe it is that if I go to climb a hill and do a big effort, there's something that's missing, something that I'm not committing to. My brain isn't activated to want to race, to have that kind of sharp, aggressive side to me. This challenge, I feel like, yeah, really helped, like, sort of get me excited for racing again. Is that what you mean?
100%. I mean, certainly at the end of the article, when he said, if that's you, then really start getting some short-term objectives in place, some mid-term, some long-term objectives, and begin to work towards those, i.e. create some momentum, however small, in your life, to begin to take the baby steps back to feeling kind of out of the fog. And I think that's probably the best way to describe it, rather than trying to over-prescribe it or over-analyze it. It's just, I felt a bit stuck and now I'm sort of unstuck.
How much of emerging from the fog, Rebecca, was the sense of adventure that comes with an outdoor record attempt, and particularly with a circuit record attempt? We know that you've previously been the Welsh 12-hour time trial champion, and that was conducted on a dual carriageway, where I guess the sense of adventure was pretty low. You know, this is a circuit around the Brecon Beacons, up the Black Mountain, the heads of the Valley Road. I mean, a real sense of adventure. How inspiring was that for you?
Yeah, totally. I think Phil's really right. You know, you just got to get back to basics. And without knowing it, that's what I was doing. I was finding something that was really intrinsically exciting for me. The chance to get to race like beautiful roads. It was almost as if somebody said to me, create your ideal race course in your home county. And, you know, many aspects of this route had those parts to it, like Black Mountain and the Bulch. I felt like I was living kind of vicariously, like through like the, you know, the life of a world tour pro rider, getting the opportunity to go up and down these beautiful mountain roads and kind of call it a race against the clock.
And all of the planning and the logistical side of it. I mean, Phil, you're no stranger to endurance riding either, having done the Tour of Britain One Day Ahead in 2018. I mean, these are things that don't come together overnight. There's a big logistical component, which I guess builds that sense of anticipation, builds the sense of adventure as much as the physical side.
Well, I just want to refer back to the podcast that we did with Rebecca and Adam, where we just specifically talked about the hill climbing community. And I remember how lit up Rebecca and Adam got when they were starting to begin to talk about specific climbs and the planning that they were, you know, going through in order to know exactly sort of what effort we're going to need to win, you know, taking account wind conditions, atmosphere, tire pressure, you know, road conditions, all of this stuff. I was like amazed by it all. So when I heard about this challenge that Rebecca had, you know, was undertaking, I just imagined if she was like that on the hill climbing, I wonder what she would have been like with this particular record. So come on, Rebecca, you better come clean. How detailed was your planning spreadsheet for this particular attempt?
Yeah, I want to say I just like got on my bike and went. But you know me.
We don't believe
like,
you.
Yeah. I feel like you know no otherwise. Well, I can't have planned it as detailed as some of those hills. But you know, Phil, from doing that tour event, that the logistics behind, like, you did, how many days did you do when you did the tour event?
Well, that was 8 days, but obviously with all the transfers in between. So it was really significant and it took me months to sort out, in all honesty. But, you know, I was really taken by what you needed to do because you're against the clock and you needed to also think about not only the logistics of, for example, where Liam's got to feed you. You know, you've got to think about your nutrition. You've got to think about, you know, the road, roundabouts, all of these things that are going to sort of trip you up along the way. So I just wondered really how detailed you went in that planning phase about your schedule that you wanted to ride to on the day.
Yeah, pretty detailed. When I initially looked at it, I probably spent about a week or two flurry of kind of like form filling, checking courses. I questioned so many people. As you can imagine, I kind of deep dive into that, you know, what is the RRA? How do I do long distance? I listened to this podcast, the RRA podcast. I literally went through every single episode trying to determine what are the attributes of a long distance rider. I think there were the initial like high level stuff I was trying to do. Liam's my coach, so I could totally trust the planning to him for kind of my training. And then about 3 months out, I was already practicing like my nutrition. What bike was I going to ride? That just took ages. Actually, I didn't even know what bike I was going to ride until the Saturday before the attempt, which is bonkers. Although I knew it was, you know, it was going to be okay. It's just a kind of a crazy time at the moment for getting parts. And it all kind of came together on Saturday. But however, everything was planned. Like, and then about a week before the attempt, when I knew I was actually going to go for it, I thought like everything was in hand. But then, you know, it took me about another 3 days solid just putting together the final details. But that's just me. I think some people will just get on their bike and ride. And then I want to know, like, what I did is I did a plan of every single segment of the ride, what I expected to achieve from that segment, even if it was just like holding back, not going too hard. I had like cut off points in my head for if I wanted to reach a target time. So things like that, really.
At that stage, Rebecca, I've got to take a quick techie time out. Techie timeout time. Your bike, your setup, your gears, your wheels, your tyres, all that. Just give us a very quick rundown with you. So I know you rode your Specialized, didn't you?
Yeah.
And did you go with an 80 mil on the back and a 50 on the front?
I think it's an 80 and a 60.
80, 60 back front. Gear-wise, what gears were you running?
On the front, I had a 53-39.
Okay. And the back?
Cassette 28-11.
28-11. So effectively... Okay, so 3911 was your climbing gear, effectively. All right, I'm going home, Tim, because I have to ride 34, 32 most of the time when I'm climbing. So kudos, Rebecca.
I'm wincing, Phil, just listening to this. I mean, having dealt with the detail, let's zoom out on the bike, because there's an interesting strategic point here, isn't there? You were permitted to use a time trial bike, but you chose not to, because actually what you're hoping to do with this record is inspire a few people along the way. Tell us a bit more about that.
Yeah, I think the real honest answer is I don't have a TT bike. But on the flip side, I could have borrowed a TT bike. And there was a couple of things about that. Firstly, like if you borrow a TT bike, you need to use it for a couple of months before. Not a big fan of borrowing someone's precious TT bike for 2 months and, you know, wear and tear. Then beyond that, what are my goals for the rest of the season? I want a road race. I want to do the hill climbs. It wouldn't make much sense for me to spend 2 months on a TT bike where you're adapting your body to, you know, that geometry. And then when I thought about it, I thought, well, actually, I'd quite like to show that these attempts are totally accessible on a road bike. You know, the circuit challenges are really new. Some of them haven't been contested yet, like the Brecon Beacon. So it's really open at the moment, and the standard times are definitely achievable on a road bike, as I showed.
You're being pretty modest here, because you were actually faster than the first male attempt, which was made on a time trial bike.
Yes, because secretly you wanted to do it just under 5 hours, didn't you, Rebecca? I seem to recall. So I think you came in at, was it 5:03? So it's clearly very doable for you. I mean, I think when I, you know, as an ordinary person was looking at this thinking, riding 100 miles on flat Cheshire lanes in 5 hours would be a problem for me. But you rode, you know, over 100 miles, and was it 103 in total?
Yeah, 104.
But there was about 6,500 feet of climbing in that 104 miles. And I'd be like, my goodness me, I'd be out on the road for about 10 hours doing that sort of course myself. So I think for most people who are sort of ordinary riders, I guess, got, you know, people like me that do things at a weekend, the average speed that you achieve to do that, which, you know, 104 miles, just over 5 hours, is that work out at 22 miles an hour or something? Or is it in that range? What's your average speed?
Well, my average speed was 20.7, because that 104, obviously, that four extra miles, it's a bit of a tricky one, because in my head I was like, yeah, it's 100 miles, 5 hours, but it's not. It's 104 miles. You know, we think a 10 might take you 30 minutes when you're like pushing along. That's kind of almost like an extra 15 minutes. So I'm really happy. I'm not going to lie. Yeah, I'm really happy with that average speed. I've never done that distance over that elevation that fast. So that's kind of what I wanted on the day, really.
I can only imagine, Rebecca. I'm still trying to target 20 miles an hour average speed on a flat Cheshire lane, let alone in the Brecon Beacons.
I wish there hadn't been some big stops on the roundabouts, and there was one set of traffic lights where I was literally unclipped, having a drink. I feel like I want to go again and do like a 4 a.m. start, miss all the traffic.
How much confidence did you take, Rebecca, going into the record from your success in winning the Welsh 12-hour time trial title? I know they're not directly comparable, but you've taken on an endurance challenge that requires a high average speed. Was that a useful banker psychologically?
Not really. Like, that 12-hour was horrible, if I remember. Like, the worst event I'd ever done. I sold my time trial bike after that. It was like the hottest day of the year, so it was 30 degrees. 2018, and I knew I had won 6 hours in because the girl had quit, but I had to finish it. And by that point, it was just a case of like turning the legs for 6 hours. This challenge was different because I was trying to actually put out some power, and I was wanted to actually perform, you know, for the whole duration. But what I did take comfort on was the fact that I've raced a lot of national series, and they're quite long and they're quite attritional. So I knew I could do it thereabouts, yeah.
And was it a more satisfying all-round experience? You know, it would have demanded far more from you as a rider, the Brecon Beacon circuit, I think, with descending and cornering and all that kind of stuff, rather than riding up and down a dual carriageway for 12 hours. Did that give you a greater sense of satisfaction?
Definitely. I'm much more of a, like, an adventurer. When I look at the 12-hour, I did it because I really was interested in the TCR, transcontinental race. I thought, well, I better do a 12-hour first. And this is about 3 weeks out from thinking about first ever doing a TCR. But actually, in hindsight, I thought, no, I'd been better doing a point-to-point, like a journey race, like a Nordax or something like that. The going up and down a bypass. I'm massively in awe of anyone who can do that, actually, and keep mentally motivated. Very difficult.
Talking of that, what during your attempt, Rebecca, was sort of the, did you have any mental highs and lows? What was actually going on in your mind, you know, at the beginning? And you know, I've heard you talk about feeling very emotional at the end, but actually, so going through that, those 5 hours, did you have any sort of lows that you had to push through?
The low came the night before, really. We didn't drive the course until the day before on the Saturday because of the local restrictions we've had in place. And the weekend before could have given me an opportunity, but I'm sure you know yourself, like once you start traveling, it really starts telling on your body. So I decided to leave it until the Saturday. We drove the 100 miles, and at that point, I got onto the A465, which is like a bypass. I hadn't realised how hilly it was. And then I got back to the Airbnb, and I was a bit teary, just sort of saying, I don't know if I want to do this. I don't even want to do this. And really, I was obviously just massively worrying that I was actually going to even get to the 6 hours standard time, having seen that bypass. And then in the morning, I woke up at 5 o'clock, and the first thought I had was, I don't want to do this. But then I got on the bike and everything settles down straight away. I was really anxious about the bypass because I knew it was going to be busy roads, and I'm a really rural kind of, I live in the countryside. And when I did get on the bypass, it was a bit noisy. But then when we got onto the A465, which was like the hilly one, everything kind of cleared off all of a sudden. It was like there was construction works and the whole bypass was empty and pretty much available for me. And then I relaxed because all I had to really deal with then were these massive climbs to get up. And then after that, we get onto this really weird section because of this diversion, which has been in place for a couple of years now, where you have to go onto this like single track lane. It is like a track now because it's all potted, you know, rutted, and cars are coming the other way because it's a diversion. And I was having to squeeze past cars. Like at one point, I just had like that much space, which is weird because I was dead worried on the bypass. But that kind of stuff I was totally familiar with because it's like back lane riding. So it was just really weird. Like I was like, well, how can I be like scared of a bypass but not of a car? Like with just giving me like 4 feet to like get by. That was the only low I had, Phil, in that respect.
The voices of doubt, which we all have. You know, that's just kind of being a human, isn't it? That you get those voices appear in your head on those big moments. And tell me about that moment, because I thought it was so lovely when you saw those people at the side of the road, Rebecca. But, you know, that, you know, filled you up, if I recall, as you were coming towards the end of the attempt. There were some people at the side of the road cheering you on.
Yeah. Well, as I came towards the 10-mile marker from the end, go up this climb called Bulch. Tim, I think you've had problems pronouncing the word Bulch.
You can tell I'm a writer, can't you? You get away with it in print. But yeah, thanks for that, Bulch. I'll bank that for future reference.
And Bulch is like this village that sits on top of a hill, and you approach it for a mile or so and you're like, oh gosh, I got to get up there. But I knew my friends were going to be there, Heather and Ben, and they'd driven with their kids all the way down from home, like a 2-hour drive, just to wave me at this point. I didn't know if they were going to be there for sure. But also it's like the last climb before like a fast 9-mile finish. And then as I got to the top, I saw them all and I was like waving. There's not much else I can do. So I just waved. And their kids, Gable and Jeff, were there, like Arthur's best friends. And as I crested over, I just started like crying, you know, getting really, really emotional, like with happiness. I don't know why that's the case, because I knew they were going to be there. Just such a like lovely thing to do, to drive all that way. And I wouldn't expect anybody to do that, you know, really touching.
And I think particularly probably after the year that we've all had, and because also this was an outlet for you, Rebecca, wasn't it? This was your thing after that very difficult period that you'd had as well. And I guess all of these things suddenly come into view when you've put such an effort in, and then suddenly you have this connection with somebody that you know as you're coming to the end of it. I can only imagine that if that were me, I'd be feeling quite emotional and quite stirred up by that moment in time, really.
Yeah, Heather and I, she's a mum at the school. When the lockdown finished last September, we said, hey, shall we just get together after school once a week? from school and go for a walk with the kids. And it was really just to get the kids together because they haven't been able to play together. And also just getting them outside because a lot, you know, they've been stuck inside a lot as well. And we've been doing that every week. We only stopped at Christmas time because, well, just before the Christmas lockdown because it just got too dark. When I saw them and I came past them, what made me feel so emotional was that I thought about Heather and me doing something for the kids each Wednesday. And now here was Heather doing something for me. And I felt really like emotional about that.
It's really touching, actually. Yeah, Rebecca, thank you for sharing that with us. And I can identify with that. In 2018, when I did the Tour of Britain one day ahead, I was going to, for a stage where we're going through Worksop, and I knew somebody that lived in Worksop, and they messaged me the night before and they said, look, I've taken the afternoon off of work and I want to stand by the road and see you. And I remember being about 3 or 4 miles out from Worksop, and I broke off the front of the bunch that we had and said, look, let me just sort of ride forward a bit there. And I can recall, here's me, a grown man in my 50s, seeing another grown man in his 50s at the side of the road and me bursting into tears. And I think what it was, I felt like I'd been putting such an effort out, you know, physically. I was becoming, the fatigue was starting to build. We'd had many days of being on the bike and then the transfers every day between destinations. And then suddenly it was seeing somebody, you know, that you've got some built up story with. And then suddenly they appear at the side of the road, and it just sort of opened the well up. So I can really identify with that sort of moment that you felt seeing your friend.
Yeah, that's really nice. It sounds like really similar. Like, you know, like you say, somebody's kind of outside of your bike community who's reaching like and connecting to you. They're not doing it because they're bike, you know, fans. They're doing it because they're your friend and they want to support you. I'm thinking from what you just said, that sounds like what's going on there.
I think it's really a touching act of human kindness at a time when perhaps we all really appreciate human kindness. And so those events almost become a little bit amplified, perhaps even more so now. But certainly back in 2018, it was probably me just feeling a bit depleted. But it's a really, really touching story. I want to ask you about food and nutrition. What were you eating and what were you drinking and what did you need to get this done?
Well, you need quite a lot of carbohydrates. I don't really know much about nutrition in terms of on the bike. You think you know a lot, but actually putting it, you know, into practice is really difficult. About a week before, a friend of mine, Andy Nichols, who's also a nutritionist, just said, do you want some advice? And I was like, yes, please. We got it down to a nice strategy where we had half my hourly carbs in a bottle. So, you know, like liquid carbs. And then I had a Rice Krispie cake. You know, the Rice Krispie squares, the Kellogg's ones, and a gel. And that kind of is about 90 grams of carbs. Really what you want to do is like, you don't really want to have fat, because as soon as you put fat into it, it slows down the digestion of carbs. So your muscles are using glycogen. You can get glycogen from carbs. Anything that slows that absorption of carbs back into your system is going to sort of impede your muscles working and things like that. So that worked really nicely. I did feel really sick actually, because obviously like drinking like and taking in 90 grams of carbs, by hour 3.5, I started feeling really nauseous. You've got to keep drinking, basically, and eating, because even if you feel sick, your body or your muscles don't know that. They still need those carbs. So I was like, as long as I'm not actually physically sick, I'm going to keep drinking and eating. And that's what I was telling myself. And that worked.
It's interesting to think of nutrition in those terms, purely in terms of fuel. We think about anything that we digest in terms of taste and flavour and enjoyment or the opposite, you know, actually to think about, well, we don't want too much fat in this because that will slow the absorption of carbohydrate. That's a very distinct perspective. I wanted to ask Rebecca, we often hear grand tour riders, don't we? Particularly riders who win from a breakaway with a stunning solo effort. They say, well, yeah, I had good legs. I knew I had good legs today. And so that's why I attacked. Did you have that sense on the ride? And if so, at what stage?
I never had that sense of good legs. The day before, I knew my legs were fresh. I knew that because you're doing your warm-up and you're like, you just having to hold back. The first hour and a half, my legs were fresh. I had to hold back on Black Mountain. But after that, I never really felt like I had an extra push in me. So I never really got tired as such. I think I paced it quite well because the fatigue just very slowly built up on me. So never at any point did I feel like I was like really like having to pedal squares. When I say pedal squares, you know, you're just like, you're just cramping up and everything's going. But at the very last drag, about a few hundred metres from the lay-by where I finished the course record, I put in a bit of a dig, probably the first one of the whole attempt. And within like a minute, my legs were totally destroyed. And at that point, I thought, well, actually, I've paced it so well because I was actually on the line for quite a long while. You know, if your legs kind of pack up that quickly, it's a good sign that you put in a good effort.
How hard was the pacing aspect? I mean, coming back again to your 12-hour time trial, I guess if you're on a pan flat dual carriageway with, you know, no scenic disruption, no reason to get up out of the saddle, no corners, no traffic, that's, you know, no oncoming traffic, I guess all you've got to think about is pacing and keeping your eye on your on-bike computer. But when you're riding, you know, over undulating terrain, to say the least, 6,500 feet of climbing in this ride, when you're constantly changing position on the bike, when you're dealing with all kinds of environmental, you know, aspects, roundabouts, traffic lights, oncoming traffic, all that kind of stuff, how hard is it to keep an eye on pacing?
Pretty hard at the beginning because you're a bit, you know, you're trying to hold back. And actually the bypass was probably the hardest part for me. It's not a terrain that I particularly like, you know, big wide roads that go on forever. And because of that, I was like in that aero position for, I think I was on the bypass for like an hour and a half. And actually by the end, I couldn't change up into my big chain ring because the nerves in my hand had got a bit trapped from being on the drop, so the pressure. So mechanically, my body was like not enjoying that so much. I had a bit of pain in my hip, which apparently is your hip flexors. They just get a bit tired because you're in that aero tuck position. So just that kind of prolonged position in the saddle, that would have been about the 3.5 hour mark. And then as soon as I got back onto the country road, you know, the really rubbish road, yeah, it was just like a new release of energy because it was like familiar type of riding for me, and I was in and out of the saddle more, and after that, it was all fine.
Rebecca, kit-wise, did you go with normal bib shorts and top, or did you wear your skin suit?
The skin suit. There's massive advantages, you know, aerodynamic advantages. Anybody wanting to do an attempt, they just need to look at the aerodynamics, you know, how can they best improve their chances of that average speed? That's what it's all about. I had a road bike, but I spent a good, again, we talked about that research aspect, Phil. I listened to like all the Aero TT podcasts. So there's like the time trial podcast, and obviously the RRA. And I was asking everybody who are, you know, who are real aero geek, what do I do? Aero Coach have got a bunch of testing available on their website about bottles. So I had a bottle on my seat stem because that's actually the most aero place to have it. And that research is out there. I had some trip socks with VeloToe shoe covers. Apparently that's a really fast combination. The Velotec suit I had has been tested, you know, and has done really well in the test. So felt pretty happy with my brother's skin suit that I had. I decided to go pure road in the end. I did also buy some clip-on bars and I practiced with that. But eventually I decided to take on a different slant with the road bike and aim at going the standard setup. So I bought a S-Works Evade helmet, which is like one of the fastest road helmets out there. Yeah, so I did a bit of research.
The tires you were using, Rebecca, I mean, I often think, you know, tires are the most overlooked component of a bicycle. It's literally the only point of contact between you and the road. And you had some very fast tires for this attempt.
Yeah, the rolling resistance of a tire on a road, that plays a massive factor as well, like as does dry or wet roads. I even read that a moist road, like a damp road, can actually be faster than a dry road. I was sort of having all these conflicting kind of amounts of research that I was listening to in the sense of like, what do I do? When do I go? I decided I wanted dry roads for cornering and everything. But the tyres I had were Corsa Speed. I think the tubeless 25mm Corsa Speed has been tested as one of the fastest in the world, which is what I chose to have on the day. And when I typed in the rolling resistance of that particular tyre at the pressure I wanted to ride at into the algorithm on my windsock, which is a piece of software where you can actually start to analyse how fast you might expect to go given your power output, weather conditions, and then kit. and position, the rolling resistance of your tyre seemed to play a massive part in changing that outcome. So, yeah, I made sure to have it on the day.
Do you practice with any of your race day setup, or did you kind of keep everything in reserve in the hope of a psychological boost, if nothing else?
Practiced with the wheels that my friend lent me. It was a bit of a beg and borrow situation. She had a lovely set of head wheels, so I wanted to practice with those. She also had a disc wheel, so I practiced with that. I also practiced non-clip versus being in the drops. The only thing I didn't practice with, like you say, was with my full skin suit. So I was hoping that would give me a slight mental boost on the day.
And Rebecca, dare I ask about your power output? Can you recall what your sort of peak was, your average was, your normalised was, just for the geeky listeners out there that like to hear such things?
Yeah, my normalised was 197 watts. I actually changed power meter the day before. I ended up using a Durace power meter, crank power meter, whereas normally I use the power tap pedals. Based on the performance I put in and the average speed, it would suggest that maybe they were slightly under reading. But let's just say I think that's about a good enough round figure there. And I think max output was about 300 watts. You know, I never really went very hard on the ride at any point.
So I guess it's, you know, that's all about power to weight ratio there, really, isn't it? I'm looking at that going, if I'm pushing 197 watts, Rebecca, I'd end up at about 17 miles an hour average on a flat road. How trained you are, your weight, and I guess all of your hill climbing experience really came into the fore on that type of circuit for you. That hilly circuit lends itself very well to your riding style and physique, I guess. So does that mean in the future you'll be looking to try and target other RRA records with similar profiles across the country? Are we going to see as great a success with these records of RRA records as we've seen with you in hill climbing?
That'd be nice. So, yeah, I can tell you the news, Phil, is that I've actually bought back my old time trial bike.
Ooh, okay, so, right. So things are getting serious again. Right, okay. So what is your time trial bike? Tell us quickly about that then.
So it's a really old Giant Trinity TT bike, and it's the same frame that Jonathan Schubert did the fastest 100 on. And when I found out that, I thought, oh, I really wish I hadn't sold that time trial bike. But I sold it to a friend of mine, and he's decided that he's not going to be racing for the foreseeable future. He's got a bit of an injury, and he literally told me a week ago that he's going to sell this bike. And I thought, no, I can't let it go because we just can't get bikes at the moment. So it was a bit weird. I'm buying it back off him.
That's a great omen, isn't it? That suddenly the universe has brought that back to you. That can only be a good thing. So what's the setup on it then? Is it got a disc wheel on it? Is it, you know, what sort of group are you running on it?
Yeah, so it's got a disc wheel and it's got a front 50. Yeah, and it's a pretty fast bike. I think the fastest 25 I did on it was a 53.53. So it can shift. I'm going to make some improvements to it though. Definitely want to play around with the body position. I always felt like I was a bit too much gap between my hands and my face. I wanted to get some more upright bars. Group set wise, I think it's a combination of Ultegra and 105, but I'm going to change all that. I hate to admit it, but it's definitely going to be faster. I kind of say that because you don't want to have to get kind of buy a TT bike because you think, oh, does it really give me speed? But all of that drag is coming from your body, and if you can get your body down and stay in that position, and then the component, you know, like having hidden brake calipers and things like that really does help. So in answer to your question, I might go for some more. Yeah,
well, I guess there's low cost watts you can acquire, and then there's high cost watts you can acquire, I guess, and you know, when you look at that scene, you can go down a rabbit hole in terms of how far you go, because ultimately it's only really as big as your wallet, really, and as big as your budget. You know, for some people, they are investing tens of thousands in their entire setup in terms of skin suit, right the way through to, you know, getting the CDA, the bike right, and your overall wind tunnel testing and all of these sorts of things, Rebecca. But I think you've got all the raw ingredients effectively. So once you get you've got the physical capability, get the technical capability, you know, tweak that as much as you can to a certain point. And those two married together, I think, will make a fairly formidable setup for some of these RRA records moving forward.
We had a wax chain to try and improve the efficiency. We didn't have bar tape. We just had electrical tape just to try and like really tightly wrap everything. They were the main things. You're just trying to make it really mechanically efficient. like I said, I did all that research. You can save a watt here or save a few watts here. And that can be a lot that can be in your drivetrain efficiency. So moving into the future, I'd always focus a lot more on that. Where can I make those easy watts, you know, save those watts without, I say without getting too geeky, but actually it is all about getting geeky, isn't it?
The savings in the drivetrain are unbelievable. I did a lot of work for Muckoff last year, and they have got PhD qualified scientists, and they work in a field called tribology, the science of friction. All of them said the sheer complexity of the bicycle chain is actually, you know, leaves everything else for dead, really. You know, it moves in different directions at the same time. You know, part of it is slack while part of it is under tension. Part of it is fixed within the link while the other part is revolving. There are so many different factors to take into consideration, you know, before you begin to formulate the loop. So yeah, huge, huge amounts to be gained there. And of course, they worked with Brad Wiggins when he broke the hour record back in 2015 and made, you know, pretty much a silent chain, which played a significant part. More prosaically, let's talk about the RRA, proper grassroots cycling. And, you know, that, of course, is Brother's calling card in this sport that the company and Phil, through the sponsorship, you know, they're really trying to give back, really trying to create platforms to perform, to support the sport at the grassroots. And it doesn't come much more grassroots than the RRA. So tell us a bit about that.
Actually, I'm just thinking about the Muckoff. That is the lube we use. Yeah, they claim it to be the, you know, the fastest lube out there.
Yeah. I spent last summer kind of trying to cling on with my fingertips to what their scientists were telling me so I could write about it. And it's the real deal. It's some proper science there. But yes, the RRA, tell us about them.
Yeah, they're a really old organisation, going back to the 1880s, actually. You did have the National Cyclists Union then. They were pushing at that in the 1880s to put all road racing onto the track because there was a lot of friction on the road between horse and carriages and cyclists.
And we're not talking drivetrain friction here, are we?
No.
Different type
we're talking
of friction.
Horses and carriages and like really heavy steel bikes. And there was like a law case where a woman kind of got, you know, her horse got frightened by a bunch of people racing past on the bike. She put in a legal case for it and they banned road racing. I think it was in the lanes of Hampshire or somewhere. But that kind of extended across the country. And there was a lawyer at the time and he worked out that there's a loophole because they're saying you're not allowed to ride together in a bunch, but there's no reason why we can't ride by yourself and just time it, which was where we got, you know, time trialing from. But it was all kind of a little bit, you know, undercover. So you had these kind of secret codes where you go meet and then that's where we get all our coding system from, cycling time trials. But actually the organization that was really at the forefront of all this was the RRA. So the RRA was set up to ratify these new forms of racing, which was the time trial. So you had the 10, you still have the 10, the 25, the 50, the 100, although most popular now are the cycling time trial courses. But then they also ratified all the long distance rides. So you had Land's End, John O'Groats, Edinburgh, London, Cardiff, London, side to side. All the big long distance records in Britain you can think of are officiated and ratified by the RRA. They have a resurgence every now and then. And I think now we're heading into one of those periods. In 2019, they bought in 6 new distance records, which are the circuit records. And they're based in 6 national parks. You have to pass about 3 or 4 checkpoints and they're officiated and they're ratified by the RRA. And if you break a record, then we'll be in their record book till they kind of finish, whenever that may be. It's a really grassroots organisation, I'd say. It's made completely of volunteers. Like, I was really surprised. Most of them seem to be nearing or past retirement, actually. And as soon as I touched base with Brian Edbert, the General Secretary based in London, within 24 hours, I had about 6 people volunteering to come and help me on the day.
You had a chap called Doug Gale come along on the day, I think. What role did he play?
Doug was the officiator. So he sits in the van with Rick and he time keeps. So he has my schedule. You've got to write out a schedule, and the schedule's got to be about, depending on the course, mine was 104 miles, and I had 13 points along that route. And I borrowed the schedule kindly off Chris Gibbard, who'd done the event in September. Now I know a bit more. This is like hindsight. After the event, I now know what a schedule is and how useful it is for the timekeeper. So every time you go past a key point, it could be a roundabout or something that has a def point to define against, you'll have said what you expect to have done by that point in terms of a time. So, you know, you say you're going to ride mile 0 to 10, and it's going to take me 30 minutes. I expect to be there in 30 minutes. So if you're there in 25 minutes, then he reports back to Brian, like she's 5 minutes up. He reports back to Mike Broadworth, who's doing the Twitter feeds. Rebecca's 5 minutes up. He starts to give a picture for the timekeeper, but also for anybody else who's shown an interest in the event. You do get enthusiasts. You just want to come and see the event. So they'll have the schedule printed off and they'll be sitting there waiting for you to go past. And, you know, the excitement is she up or is she down on her schedule? The problem was, is that I got my schedule slightly wrong and that I expected to do 10 miles in 1 minute at one point in my schedule. So I'd actually come. So that really threw Doug, because he was like, he thought, like, you know, that was a massive mathematical error to think I could do 10 miles in 1 minute. Yeah. So he's just checking that we're not doing anything out of hand, like, you know, getting drafting off descent. The following car or I don't know, sticky bottle maybe.
You mentioned Rick in the mix there. He's your partner. He's a formidable hill climber himself and a mechanic.
Yeah, Rick's my partner and he's a mechanic and he's a really good hill climber. He's really into it. Like, he's really into cycling, full stop. Like, not just like cycling, but the whole, like, you know, scene, the history of it. You know, him and Doug got on really well, actually. Just two enthusiasts. Rick will help out with his team. Like, he'll do the team, he'll drive the team car at the prems, and, you know, he's just, you know, one of a bunch of people who just really enjoy being involved with cycling. Yeah, and he's a great person to have around on a day like that.
Just following on there, Rebecca, you know, telling us about the Road Records Association and a very grassroots organization, and while you were telling us that, you mentioned that, you know, Chris Gibbard had shared his schedule with you, that you'd been in touch with Mike Broadwith. It does seem to have that same community spirit as the hill climb. Would that be fair?
Definitely, yeah. Hill climb scene, as soon as you get involved, you'll just find that, like, there's loads of people who want to kind of contact you and say, how about you try this, how about you do this, you know, offering help, going, why don't you go for that hill. And I was really amazed to find, like, another community like that out there in the RRA. I think I call them long distances. They're just absolutely fanatic about doing crazy challenges. Like, Mike Broadwith is the current Land's End to John O'Groats record holder, a math teacher, a family man, he's got a few kids, and yeah, just insane what he did. And he keeps dropping hints for me to do the 24-hour and Land's End John O'Groats. Now, I've only just done a 5-hour ride. I'm not sure about doing 24 hours. Yeah, just a different breed. But then you say they're the same breed because hill climbers are just fanatics as well about going up hill climbs. So I have to choose which camp I'm in now because they don't quite marry up very well together.
Well, look, Rebecca, thank you very much indeed for joining us today. It's been fascinating to hear all about the attempt from the inside. Let's finish in our normal fashion. We always round up with what we call the social shout out. So Rebecca, let's start with you. If people wanted to follow you on social media, on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram, how can they do that?
Twitter is RRA_design. That's my business, not the RRA. And Instagram is box_Richardson.
That's BOCS_Richardson. Brilliant. Thank you. Phil, where can people find you on social media?
Yeah, best place to find me is probably on Twitter for cycling related matters at RoadPhil. If you do have a bit of business in your mind at any time, you can find me at PhilJones40, that is.
And if you'd like to follow Brother Cycling on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, you can find us at Brother Cycling, all one word, on all three channels. Rebecca, Phil, thank you very much indeed for joining me today. Thank you very much indeed for listening, and stay safe.
If
you've enjoyed today's episode, please hit subscribe.